This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle issue 173 for the week beginning Monday, the 21st of November, 2011, with me, Zaltor the Merciless, instigator of irrefutable doom. Who's boss? I'm boss. And with me, well, it's none of your business. Actually, it is some of your business. It's probably going to be also quite obvious as soon as he starts talking. But what's he going to cook up for you today? Will it be chuckle chowder? Will it be laughter laxa? A mirth minestrone or a giggle gumbo? Maybe we'll just be bullshit borscht, or viciously satirical vichyssoise, or just simply a good gag gazpacho. Whatever, it's going to be super. It's John Oliver!
Hello, Andy! Hello, Buglers! Andy, I did a very strange charity gig last weekend.
Oh, yeah.
It was a gig for the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research at the Waldorf Astoria in front of what was probably about 1,000 hedge fund managers. And I tell you what hedge fund managers love, Andy. Comedy. Yeah. They love it. They absolutely love it, especially when it's comedy about how statistically some of them should probably be in jail. That is one of the top five things they find funny. The other four things are all about having lots of money. It was an odd bill, including me, Kid Cudi, Ricky Gervais, and Michael J. Fox himself. Now, Andy, I'm 34 years old. That made me 8 years old when Back to the Future came out, and I was f***ing obsessed with that movie. I love Marty McFly. I even decided that I wanted to learn to skateboard because of him before trying it out once, deciding it was too hard and thinking I'd try to find out what Calvin Klein underwear was instead. And for the finale of the show, Michael J. Fox, or Marty McFly to give him his real name, Doc Hollywood to his friends, played Johnny B. Goode on the old Back to the Future guitar. I was standing off stage, Andy, right where, in the movie, the guy makes the phone call saying, Chuck! Chuck! It's Marvin! Your cousin Marvin Berry! You know that new sound you're looking for? Well, listen to this! That was my view, Andy. And my head felt like it was going to explode. It was like the eight-year-old version of myself finally making peace with me, saying, look, you've let me down in every career choice that I wanted. You're not a professional footballer. You're not Marty McFly. And you're not a giraffe. But this is close enough, John. This might be close enough. It was amazing.
That does sound pretty good.
Yeah, it was amazing.
What was Ricky Gervais doing at this moment?
I think he was out in the crowd at that point, right, jumping around. And Kid Cudi was recovering from also being ignored by hedge fund managers.
All right.
Who is this Kid Cudi? Does he have as much money as I? I doubt it, rather.
So this is Bugle issue 173 for the week beginning Monday, the 21st of November, which means that it is exactly 134 years since Thomas Edison invented the phonograph, without which this podcast, or to give it its pre-shortening name, Phonographed Broadcast, would not have been possible. Amongst Edison's 1,092 other patented inventions, the light bulb, the motion picture camera, the squeaky duck, the automatic spouse insulter, that was the must-have 1887 Christmas accessory for the lazy husband or wife, the big foam finger, the goldfish, that's another Edison invention, the gaydar, first man to invent the gaydar, the automatic priest, came with three settings, forgive, admonish and confuse, the prophylactic bow tie, that's not 100% reliable, but it was quite successful due to being A, very difficult to put on, B, visually ridiculous, rendering the wearer sexually unalluring to all women other than those erotically aroused by the sense of impending pomposity, and C, coated in a fatal poison. And of course, Thomas Edison's most valuable invention, the proton pack, later copied by Egon Spengler in the Ghostbusters.
Whoa, big claim.
Yeah, well, you know, if it's not true, then I'd like to hear from Spangler's lawyers. 21st November also, John, is World Hello Day, in which you're supposed to say hello to 10 people to bring about world peace.
Oh, yeah.
The 22nd of November is then World Oh, Hi, Do I Know You Day. 23rd of November is World Not Yet, But Can I Interest You in a Free Bonsai Tree? 24th of November is World Not Right Now, I'm Kind of Busy. I'm late for my bagel appointment. 25th of November is World... all right, no need to be such a dick about it, Day. 26th of November is I'm not being a dick, you're being a dick, Day. And 27th of November is World... Super f***ing prick wasting my f***ing time, Day. Also, the 19th of November, this Saturday, is International Toilet Day. So do make sure that in recognition of this extremely important day, Buglers, you do lock a family member in the lavatory for 24 hours. Sunday, the 20th of November, is the 26th anniversary of the release of Microsoft Windows 1.0.
Oh.
A landmark day for swearing, John. The amount of swearing in the world has increased by 284% since Windows started pissing people off on a daily basis. As always, a section of the Bugle is going straight in the bin this week. A section about the new chess pieces being introduced by the International Chess Federation to make chess more relevant to the modern world, including the exploding dissident that takes out itself and all pieces within one square of it, including those on its own side. A little bit counterproductive, but they seem to like it. The politician piece, which, whenever it's approached by a piece from the opposition team, automatically moves one square to the side and allows the piece behind it to be taken instead. And the lawyer, which can be brought into the game when you're in check to slow down the eventual checkmate by up to 10 years through a convoluted appeals process. It's not particularly effective, but it really annoys your opponent. That section in the bin!
Top story this week, democracy health check! Andy, democracy as a system of government is old, and you know, it's not in the greatest health, so it's important that once in a while it has regular checkups where we can stick a finger up its arse and make sure that everything's okay up there. Well, this week we're going to lubricate our fingers and ask a number of countries from around the world to relax and try to think of something on a beach. First up in the waiting room, nervously sifting through an old copy of Horse and Hound, Italy news! Italy's democracy diet has not been too healthy, and it's been living for years under a bronzed, sex-crazed career criminal who spent more time on tanning beds than he spent looking at his country's budget. So,
what,
Italy...
Tony Blair? Boom!
Oh, wow. Andy, that would have been a great joke 10 years ago.
Oh, no, that's such a shame we weren't there for that.
Italy has decided to make a long overdue change and add a bit more fibre to its diet. Fibre in the form of dour technocrat Mario Monti. And like a bowl of bran flakes, Andy, you know that Mario Monti might be good for you, but that doesn't make him any more flavourful. And does Italy really want to take regular fiscal dumps quite that badly that they're willing to start every day with a spoon of Mario Monti in their mouth?
Yeah, the technocrats have taken over, and the reason for this, John, is not entirely due to Silvio Berlusconi. It is more due to the fact that the Italian public has kept voting for Berlusconi. They have shown that they simply cannot be trusted with democracy. I think they probably all need to just let these technocrats do their digestive work and just take 20 years off voting and work out exactly what they're trying to do to themselves.
Prime Minister Monti has outlined plans to tackle the country's economic problems and cut its debt. The former EU commissioner said austerity measures would be balanced by economic growth and social fairness. Wow. Those are bran flakes that have been left in the milk too long, Andy. That is exactly the kind of dour realism that Italy both badly needs and has absolutely no interest in putting in their face. Amid student protests across the country, Prime Minister Monti told senators in Rome that the future of the euro also depends on what Italy will do in the next few weeks. The euro then released a statement from its intensive care hospital bed that read, "Oh, please don't say that. Please don't say I'm counting on Italy. I'm trying to find reasons to live here."
So it's an interesting form of government in the modern democratic age in which we've been fighting wars to give democracy to people, and now Italy is taking the lead in taking that democracy away from them again in case they do themselves even more damage. And it's not quite Aristotle's benevolent dictatorship, but at least it is a government not populated by careerist egomaniacs, crooks and f***wits. Hopefully. I guess there's always time. They can turn, John. I think Monty's got a few clubs in his bag that we haven't yet seen.
Oh, that's definitely true. But that's a good point. The Italians did not vote for Monti. They've been prescribed him. And that might have been the only way, because I'm not sure that he could successfully have been elected in a general election with campaign promises along the lines of what he's talking about now. He said that he intends to overhaul the pension system, which he said has large disparities in treatment and unjustified privileges for certain sectors. He also said there'd be a crackdown on tax evasion and changes to the taxation system, saying that the absence of a property tax on main households, abolished by, guess who, Berlusconi, was an Italian anomaly. And Italians have responded to this by saying, what? Do you just want me not to be Italian at all, then? Why don't you just ban spaghetti, impound my scooter and cut my balls off, because I don't recognise the country I'm living in anymore. Maron! Maron! The new Prime Minister's plan has received almost unanimous support in the Italian Senate, but for Italians who yearn for a simpler time when no one gave a shit about the budget and instead enjoyed watching their Prime Minister goose teenage girls in bikinis, there's a glimmer of hope on the horizon. One party, the right-wing Northern League, says it will withhold its support for the new measures, and former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has reportedly said he could, I quote, pull the plug on the government if he does not like what it does. He's already plotting a comeback, Andy. He's like James Brown. He's got the towel around his shoulders. He's being escorted off the stage by the crew. And it seems like the gig's over. But hold on. What's that? His leg's twitching. The crowd's going wild. He's thrown off the towel and he's back into a turbo-funky version of Sex Machine. Prime Minister Monti is not the father of Italy, Andy. He's the responsible stepdad. And that's a real difference. He's, sure, trying to raise Italy into a well-rounded group of productive adults, but it doesn't help having Italy's biological father, Berlusconi, outside, revving his sports car and promising to take them underage drinking.
In other democracy news now, the Occupy Wall Street protest has been hosed out of its previous lodging. Mm-hmm. And last Saturday, John, I did a gig at the Occupy London protest. And, you know, we pretty much brought capitalism to its knees with an hour of music, comedy and performance poetry. And
it's the performance poetry that always tips it.
But I was steering that ship, John. I was comparing it, and you know, you can't help but think just 4 or 5 days later, the police waded in with batons in New York. I thought, well, you know, we've seen what the Bugle can do. We've seen what it's done to Mubarak. We've seen what it's done to Gaddafi. And we cannot take that risk.
Yeah.
So you're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
But the reasons given for clearing the Occupy Wall Street protest range from hygiene and public safety, and New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg thinking he might have dropped his lucky cuddly buffalo there and he really wanted to find it because he couldn't sleep at night, and just something to pass the time of day. As the protesters were cleaned out, some onlookers apparently shouted at them, "Get a job," to which I suppose the obvious retort would have been, that is kind of what this whole thing is about.
In an ideal world, that will happen. Yeah.
The protesters have carried on their protests around New York and in favour of radical reform to Wall Street, for example, encouraging the banking sector to use basic arithmetic instead of a roulette wheel and a hammer in the testicles. And people have been increasingly hacked off by the rising levels of inequality in America and around the Western world. So mass unemployment has chomped its spiky gnashes into America's one remaining buttock. But at the same time, sales of luxury goods have continued to rise.
USA! USA!
That's what the Founding Fathers were dreaming of, I think, when they set this whole shebang up.
Yeah.
But a compromise has now been reached, John, whereby whenever a millionaire buys a really expensive car, the car salesman is legally obliged to say to him, "You know this represents an economic system that is totally unsustainable long-term." The millionaire then legally has to nod and say, "Yep, I do know that. Now give me the f***ing keys."
I think everyone would be fine with that. It's more transparency, Andy. That's what this government wants, transparency without any kind of change. Activists released a statement, the Occupy Wall Street activists, saying that while they may have been physically removed from Zagotti Park, they said, and I quote, "You can't evict an idea whose time has come." Here's the thing. They are definitely going to try and evict that idea as well, Andy. They're going to tear gas the shit out of that idea.
Some executives have complained that the protests have distracted them. One trader who wished to remain anonymous said, "It's hit me real bad. When I went to the titty bar for lunch with a dubious Russian oil magnate, I could hardly concentrate on the titties." But they've claimed to be representing the 99% of people, the protesters. And the problem is that I think they need to be more specific who exactly these 99% of people are. I mean, 99% of people have not ridden a hippo. Is this what this is all about?
Mm-hmm.
99% of people have not eaten a live mackerel whilst unicycling. Or experiment, see whether if you fill your car's petrol tank with hamsters, it would still work. And if so, whether it would work squeakily or not. So I think, I mean, this is the problem with this protest, you know, apart from not coming up with fully costed alternatives for the entire global economy. So they haven't been, you know, I want line-by-line breakdown of exactly where all the money's coming in from and going out to. Otherwise, what is the point of these protests? You know, if you cannot hold up a placard big enough to have a comprehensive solution to all the world's economic problems, you shouldn't hold a placard up at all, John.
Well, it's like with the anti-Iraq war protest, Andy. Unless you can come up with a workable solution for demilitarising some of the most dangerous areas of the world, then what are you doing out there?
Yeah. I mean, not many of those anti-war placards had detailed historical backgrounds on the political machinations that led to the creation of Iraq and the social and religious pressures that have influenced it since. And that, to me, undermined the whole point of those protests.
Get a job!
How does this clearing away of this annoying visual conscience from Wall Street's proximity affect America's proudly proclaimed status as the world's daddy dongle dick of democracy? And the problem is, John, we've seen unsightly bits of democracy sprouting up in inconvenient places. Mm-hmm. And people forgetting that voting once every 4 or 5 years should be plenty enough for democracy for anyone. And we've seen this set against the opening gambits in the presidential campaign for next year's interminable presidential race. And it's kind of shown the two sides of American democracy in fairly harsh light. It seems to me, I've not watched that much of the debate so far, but it seems to me that the level of debates in the Republican nomination debate so far has been approximately the same level of debate that you often hear late at night between two angry foxes squabbling over a rubbish bin.
Well, Andy, democracy is not a right, it's a franchise. And the licensee really should be saying who can have it and when. Where is the true fountain of democracy, Andy? It's not Greece. I'm talking about a real fountain, like the ones in front of the Bellagio in Vegas. Huge fountains that shoot up 70 foot in the middle of the desert, wasting a heroic amount of water. That kind of fountain. Where is the real get your photo taken in front of it fountain of democracy? America, baby! Woo! Now, America, as you say, has been, over the last few months, stretching out his hamstrings for next year's all-you-can-eat democracy bonanza. And there has really been so much going on in the world over the last couple of months that we haven't had a chance to touch on what's been happening in the race to be President of the United States. The Republican Party, as you mentioned, have been taking part in a series of candidate debates in order to vomit up a nominee to run against President Obama next year. So let's have a quick run through the inedible buffet of possibilities that encompass the whole rainbow of whack jobbery that is the Republican candidates. First, there's Herman Cain, the non-politician CEO of Godfather's Pizza. That's right, rest of the world. The CEO of a low-grade pizza chain is in the running to be the custodian of the nuclear arsenal. Though running for office was rumoured just to be a publicity exercise for Herman Cain to sell his book, he has, through absolutely no fault of his own, suddenly found himself at the top of the polls. Then, recently, it emerged that a woman had received a settlement years ago for sexual harassment claim, and another woman stepped forward alleging sexual assault in a car around the same time. So, can a pizza-chomping horn dog be elected leader? Only in Italy, my friend, and in America in 92 and 96. But Herman Cain does
1892 and 1896.
Herman Cain does seem to have a look in his eyes that says, why is everyone still asking me questions? This whole campaign was supposed to be over by now. You don't seriously think I should be president, do you? Oh, shit! Then there's Michelle Bachmann, a congresswoman from Minnesota and first-class ticket holder on the crazy train. She briefly led in the polls, only to start to fall when it turned out that she thought the HPV vaccine caused retardation and that her suspiciously flamboyant husband ran a clinic that tried to cure gay people of their gayness. There's Ron Paul, the libertarian, whose intellectual consistency makes him a perfect candidate for president in 1835, just not now. Texas Governor Rick Perry joined the race late and came in hot, campaigning on a platform of basically being a turbo Bush, which was and remains a terrifying prospect. Luckily, he imploded after a series of debate performances so bad that Nancy Reagan threw a towel onto the stage and called for the debate moderators to ring the bell. Newt Gingrich is also experiencing something of a resurgence surges in the polls, but is unfortunately hamstrung by being Newt Gingrich. Rick Santorum is a platinum-grade arsehole. John Huntsman is a genuine threat, a smart, moderate man who speaks fluent Chinese. That's why he's currently polling a distant last. He's even had to hide the fact that he speaks Chinese. And the fact that that is viewed as a weakness shows exactly what state the base of the GOP is currently in. And all of these candidates are being circled and recircled and recircled again as the Republicans desperately trying to avoid choosing the candidate they're going to have to choose but don't even like, Mitt Romney. And that basically brings you up to speed.
Well, it sounds like it's a great era for democracy in America, John. Sounds like, I don't know, maybe that. I think maybe the problem is that, you know, they've given democracy to Iraq and they've, you know, given democracy to Afghanistan and they've just not kept enough democracy for themselves. Just scrabbling around for the scraps.
Yep.
When Rick Perry had that slightly unfortunate incident in that debate when he forgot one of the three key planks of his own economic policy, there was a kind of
amazing.
An awkward silence. And if you replay that, John, on your television, you turn up the sound really loud. In the background, you can hear this faint kind of retching. It's kind of... And that, John, is the sound of the Founding Fathers vomiting in their graves.
The opposite of democracy news now, Syria. And President Assad of Syria's attitude to democracy, Andy, is the same as his attitude to walnuts. He's fairly sure that he's allergic to them and thinks it's safest if he crushes them violently under his foot. So that's what he's been doing. He's been smashing any walnut that even thinks about looking at him.
Well, you say that, John, but, you know, he's amazingly popular. He was elected in 2000 with 97.2% of the votes.
That's true.
And he backed that up in 2007 when he was approved for another seven-year term with 97.6% of the votes. So he'd gone up.
That's, you can't argue with those numbers.
You cannot. I mean, that's even better than Blair did here, John.
Yeah.
That's, I mean... You cannot. I mean, aside from the fact that he does look a bit like he might be a professional golfer, I don't think you can. You can't. Yeah. You can't argue with those.
You're right.
Argue with those statistics.
Do you know what? I take back my walnut joke. You know, it was a glib joke. I wasn't fully aware of the facts at that point, and I take it back. Yeah.
He has shown himself very adept so far at not taking a f***ing hint.
Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, the international community is starting to be slightly more vociferous in its demands that Assad stop being such a massive tool. I believe that was the technical term used in the Arab League's statements this week. He's so far failed to meet the demands of the world to be less of a massive tool. I don't know where exactly the defined threshold is for how much of a tool you're allowed to be before the world intervenes.
Mm-hmm.
All he knows is that Gaddafi did eventually cross it, and Assad now seems to be dangling his toes over it, just seeing what happens.
Well, yeah, that threshold is key. Things have gotten so bad in Syria that the Arab League has given Syria...
John. Did you say gotten?
I said gotten.
You will lose your passport for that. You will rightly lose your passport.
The Arab League has given Syria 3 days to, quote, stop the bloody repression of protesters and allow in teams of observers. Or, I tell you what, Andy, they could just ask them to stop the bloody repression rather than giving them a 3-day buffer zone. Oh, look, go crazy for the next few days, get it out of your system, but then you've really got to halt this. You would think that it's impossible to denounce a nation with more vagueness than that. Well, try this. Qatari foreign minister said that the diplomatic efforts were, I quote, close to the end of the road. Oh, so nearly so decisive, Andy. It's close to the end of the road. How close? Hard to say. And it might not be the end of the road. It might actually just be a bend. It's hard to tell from here, but we're getting close to it, so we'll know soon. Oh, do you know what? I think it might be a T-junction with another road to go down. I just don't know. Stop it, please, in a bit.
He said in an interview in 2006 that democracy in Syria was a tool to a better life.
Right.
But also added that it would take time for democracy to come about and that it could not be rushed. And for once, this is a politician living up to his word, John.
Right.
He is ensuring that democracy is not rushed. And he is really putting the brakes on in slightly alarmingly violent manner.
The Arab League seem to be finally stepping up to the plate. And the Arab League has been a very literal boys' club for decades. A place for dictators to hang out, shoot pool and compare stupid buildings. But they have been rocked by the recent Arab Spring this year and have been jolted into moments of uncharacteristic action. Last weekend, they voted to suspend Syria's membership after it failed to honour the terms of an Arab League peace plan. The plan involved Syria withdrawing tanks from resistive cities, stopping attacks on protesters, and engaging in dialogue with the opposition within 2 weeks. But since then, violence across Syria has escalated. So Syria listened to that plan, they absorbed the plan, they thought about it, they enjoyed the 2 weeks of buffer violence, and then did the opposite of stop. So chalk that up, Andy, as another W for the Arab League. And by W, I don't mean win, I mean waste of time.
Well, it's just probably some confusion about the small prints in stopping the violence.
Right.
We just misinterpret it as, you know, ratchet the violence up, try to break the record for the most protesters killed in a month, 3-2-1, away you go. You know, we all... There's two sides to every coin, John. Moscow has called for dialogue. Now, bearing in mind that Russia sold Syria $3.8 billion of weapons last year, you might not think this is the most constructive of participants in this debate. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that weapons were being smuggled into Syria to be used by the opposition, and he said it was necessary to stop violence no matter where it comes from. And perhaps he should have thought of that before pocketing those $3.8 billion. Did he think those weapons were for a fancy dress party? Hey, I like your Elvis costume. Thanks, what are you, a Triffid? No, I've actually come as Nancy Reagan. Sorry, my mistake. Have you seen what Ahmed's wearing? Awesome, he's come as the entire Soviet arsenal of conventional weapons from 1988. Absolutely uncanny. The problem with calling for dialogue, John, is that dialogue takes many forms, from the here is our position, tell us your position, we'll talk about it like grown-ups and attempt to hammer out a real resolution that is agreeable to both parties kind of dialogue, to the f*** you, no f*** you, is there any room for a manoeuvre in your f*** you, no, there's none in mine, what about in your f*** you, no, I'm sticking with f*** you as well, well at least we're agreed on that, f*** you kind of dialogue. Which, is, of course, is the one that tends to be favoured in the Middle East, for fear of appearing weak. Your emails now, and this one comes in on the subject of Bugle and JFK assassination. Uh-oh. I hope they're not going to uncover this at last. Anyway, hello, Andy, Chris and John, brackets in order of their likely involvement in a JFK hit. I was watching a documentary called JFK, Three Shots That Changed America. Oh, yeah, sorry. Three shots. I'd assume that was the last three shots from the 1985 World Snooker Final. But,
oh, my God.
When a contemporary newscast was shown, on the screen was the Channel 8 News logo and the famous photo of Lee Harvey Oswald being shot by Jack Ruby. What chilled my blood, however, was not the sight of one of history's most famous assassins being assassinated, but the music that introduced this scene. It was the Bugle theme tune.
Oh, my God.
My mind spun as I realised the obvious implications. The congressman's penis was clearly a thinly veiled postscript of the Warren Commission's unfinished work. Was the congressman really Judge Earl Warren? Or did LBJ, or more likely J. Edgar Hoover, have Warren's metaphorical todger in an iron grip, twisting every time he got close to the truth? I've always dismissed John Grisham as a lightweight. Little did I know that he provided, via Andy's eerily accurate Sam Spade impersonation. That is eerily accurate, given that I've never heard of Sam Spade. Well, it's good that I can impersonate him. The final pieces of a puzzle that has bested people with little or nothing better to do for almost 50 years. Regards, Danny Butler in Melbourne.
Busted.
Yep.
Busted, we are. Andy.
Yep.
There's another great email here from Francesco Giacometti. What a name.
Yeah.
What a name. Great surname. I hope he's as good as sculpting as his grandfather was. He says, Dear Andy, John and Chris, I was surprised when I heard this week's Bugle that the former president of Ecuador, Abdallah Bucaram, was not included in the section of singing corrupt despots. Please enjoy these jewels. Now, Andy, he included some links of this president singing from his various albums, and it is a real treat. Here you go. Here's the first one. Let me just press play. Now, you think at this point, uh-oh, there's no way he's taking on Elvis. There's just no way. You'd be wrong. That's a strong effort. Now, if you think...
Very much, that's very reminiscent of some of Stanley Baldwin's work in the early 30s.
Now, if you're concerned, Andy, oh, well, maybe he just does the upbeat stuff, you'd be wrong about that, because... How about this live image of him arriving at a gig in a f***ing helicopter in Ecuador? We've all... yeah. And for this, it's not going to be Elvis. He's going to take it down a couple of notches, and he's going to sing from his Ecuadorian heart. He's wearing a moustache. There are some images of poor Ecuadorians in the video that he is directly responsible for. He's hugging an indigenous Ecuadorian. That's the only time he did that. Now he's in a homemade canoe, sailing across a lake, touching children in the face. There's a thin line between touching and punching, and he stayed the right side of it there. Listen to that passion, Andy. He's not singing, he's shouting it. I don't think there's ever been a singer as angry in every song as him.
I like it.
Yeah. It's like a young Peter Frampton.
Well, there's a little of the Neil Diamond about him and, you know, a lot of the Mussolini.
Yeah. Well, Neil Diamond was never... Well, he was never explicit about his interest in Ecuadorian politics, but, you know, it was always very much a subtext.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, in Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, the girl was clearly Ecuador, and the woman was a major world power.
And we've had a few nominations for the Big Brass Balls competition.
Yeah.
This one was sent in by Stephen Scherer in Albany, New York, who writes, "Dear John, Andy, Chris and Hoagie the dog, in order of likelihood to be drinking out of the toilet in the next 24 hours. well, you know us too well, to be honest. That was descending order. I'd like to offer a spectacular candidate for the official Bugle Big Smoky F***ing Brass Balls Award. Mm-hmm. The candidate is David Crowe, the CEO of British American Tobacco. After the Australian government last week passed a plain package law for cigarettes, Mr. Crowe and his fellow scumbags threatened to flood the market with cheap cigarettes. They also accused the Australian government of copyright infringement and violating free trade agreements. But the real shine on these smoky brass balls comes in the form of this quote. We will obviously focus on pricing, given it's the only thing left really to focus on and differentiate brands. More people would smoke. We all know things get cheaper and people buy more. And more kids will smoke, and that is obviously completely opposite to what the government intends. Translation, I'm not saying I want to shoot this baby in the head, but you are really making it difficult for me to operate in an environment where I don't need to shoot babies in the head on a regular basis. Those, sir, are some gigantic, big, smoky, f***ing brass balls. Yours in Christ, Steve Scherer, Albany, New York." So there you go. Well done. Well done, David Crowe from BAT. Super effort, that. Nomination number one in the Big Smoky Brass Balls. And there'll be more Big Brass Balls next week.
Great.
Do keep your nominations coming into the Bugle at timesonline.co.uk.
2 weeks.
Oh, 2 weeks. Yeah, we're off next week.
We're off next week, and it's Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
Have some f***ing respect, Andy.
Right. Well, I don't know. I say thanks every day, John. I need to make a special day about it. Every day I get up and thank something.
Yeah, but this is very specifically thanking a group of hardcore fundamentalist Christians for making corn from stolen seeds.
Sport news now, and, well, with the world has seen some platinum-grade crackpot leaders departing office this year, as we've seen. But there is one man who is holding fort, and luckily he's not in charge of a country, he's merely in charge of a sporting organisation. That man, of course, is Sepp Blatter.
Yeah.
And this week he added to his impressive portfolio of ludicrous comments by suggesting that if racist insults are exchanged between players on the pitch, they can be settled merely with a handshake at the end of the match.
Oh dear.
And that will make everything fine.
Yes. And it's football... just like...
Football responded with one voice by saying, "Mr. Blatter, you are a turbo dick." He also suggested that genocide is fine as long as it happens on the field of play within the 90 minutes.
We've lost some of, as you mentioned, some of the most eccentric leaders around this year, Andy. Gaddafi, Berlusconi, Bin Laden. But it's easy not to miss any of them when they're all embodied in Sepp Blatter, president of FIFA and professional Pierre Pouwar, the executive director of Football Against Racism in Europe, condemned Blatter's comments, saying, "You just don't expect the world leader of football to be coming out with comments that seem ill-thought-out and insensitive." Yes, you do. This is Sepp Blatter we're talking about. He's been here for years. The man's a f***ing arsehole.
The Professional Footballers Association head, Gordon Taylor, said that Blatter should resign, and he said, "I feel this is the straw that broke the camel's back." Well, John, for years, that camel has been lying on the floor, writhing around, screaming, "Ow, my back is really sore." In fact, Blatter spent most of his career kicking that camel in its already shattered spine, giggling to himself and thinking of ways to annoy people.
That's right, the camels look out and think, "I can't move. I can't feel my hooves."
But I think we in Britain, we should applaud this. The idea that you can settle anything with a handshake, which I believe is pretty much how we wrapped our empire up. Mm-hmm. Was that, there you go. That's us out of here. All done. Let's shake on it. Right, we are now quits. Good luck. We'll send the tiger skins back in the post. Do pop over any time.
In case you think Candy and I are coming on a little strong here, here's a little highlights package of Sepp Blatter's greatest goals from over the years. In 2004, he suggested that women wear tighter shorts to increase the popularity of women's football. In 2010, Sepp Blatter said that gay fans going to the 2022 World Cup in Qatar, where homosexuality is illegal, should refrain from sexual activity. And when John Terry was stripped of the England captaincy in 2010 following an alleged affair, Blatter suggested that he would be applauded in Latin countries. F*** you, Sir Blatter. F*** you.
After awarding the 2022 World Cup to Qatar on the grounds that A, he'd always wanted to see what happens if you make elite athletes run around in 50-degree heat for 2 hours, and B, he wanted to see the looks on people's faces when he read the words out, "The winner is Qatar," without following up with the words, "Ah, got ya." He made this comment where he advised homosexuals to simply refrain from being so goddamn homosexual during the tournament.
This man, there's
nothing that he will not turn his hand to, John. Or isn't there? Because aside, you mentioned the women. He'd also described the way footballers are transferred between clubs as modern slavery. And this was whilst talking about Cristiano Ronaldo, who's transferred for $80 million and paid around about £250,000 a week, which, even with 200 years of inflation, I think is a little bit more than the average plantation worker got. I guess they didn't have quite such pushy agents bumping up their transfer fee and wage packets, though. But there's one group that he has not turned his fire on, John. He's insulted blacks, women's, gays. And I know what you're all thinking here, buglers. Why has Sepp Blatter laid off the Jews? What have my people done wrong to escape this imbecile scattergun shitheadery?
Yeah.
And the answer is, John, he has delegated. Because the president of the Argentinian Football Association, one of Blatter's key allies, sod it, let's call him a henchman. why not? Can you actually have a henchman if you are nice or not? Do you have to...
Yeah.
I
don't know. Do you not have to be a bit of a dick to get a henchman?
No, Andy. That's a very offensive generalisation.
Really? I thought if you're nice, a henchman is just a secretary. But
oh, God, Andy, no? you're going to have the henchman's union coming down on you like a ton of bricks.
Well, anyway, his henchman, the Argentinian FA president, Julio Grondona, who has been variously described as an embarrassment to his entire continent. That is a big area to embarrass simultaneously. Also likes to be known as the Godfather, which is not usually the sign of someone with an appropriate level of self-awareness and modesty. But anyway, Grondona said, "I do not believe a Jew can ever be a referee at the highest level. It's hard work, and you know Jews don't like hard work."
Oh, my God.
So there you go. And this was 8 years ago, John. What is this man doing now? He is still in FIFA in one of the top positions alongside Sepp Blatter. I guess we should just be thankful, John, that Grondona and Blatter are mercifully restricted to the relatively safe area of sports admin.
Yes.
Because in the same way that a couple of different turns early in life could have turned Colonel Gaddafi into a circus entertainer instead of a brutal despot, if Blatter had taken the other fork in the road, he could so easily have ended up sitting in the dock in The Hague watching the tide roll. Oh, that's what. And refusing to recognise the legitimacy of the court. Every time I hear the latest verbal atrocity Blatter has committed, I think to myself, this is a great day for humanity. This could have been so much worse.
Andy, Sepp Blatter has giant, giant brass balls flanking what has to be a tiny penis.
So that's it for the Bugle this week. As we are off next week because John has to be thankful about stuff.
Yes,
we don't need to do that in Britain. You know, we're all
ungrateful.
Thankful. We are a mixture of ungrateful and disorganised.
Ungrateful, disorganised and entitled.
That's right.
The story of the British Empire.
The rest of the world should be saying thank you to us. We should have a thanks receiving day, not a Thanksgiving day. but we'll be back. We'll put something out next week. Any ideas, what, Chris?
Well, given that, I know the audience won't notice this, but we've been going on 25 minutes too long today already. I don't think we'll be short of material for next week.
Okay.
Some extra bits of today's astonishing show. Mm-hmm. And we'll be back with Bugle 174 in 2 weeks' time. Goodbye, Buglers.
Bye, Buglers. Happy Thanksgiving and happy Evacuation Day. Farewell.